Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG Pod Overflow, the Cinephobe Cold Opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
You said the OG Pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG Pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG Pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Hey, listener, Zach Harper here. Underdog Fantasy, the easiest place to play fantasy sports. Also, fastest growing fantasy app in the industry. Here's how it works. The Pick'em game. Pick whether your favorite players will have a higher or lower stat total in this week's game for a chance to win big. How big, you ask? I'm so glad you asked that question, listener. You can win up to 100 times your money in a single night. Pick between 2 and 5 players, build a pick'em entry. You can also do rivals picks. You can put like Tyrese Haliburton and Jalen Brunson against each other, and whoever has more points, more assists, more rebounds, whatever you want to do, that is your rivals pick. I would maybe go with Jalen Brunson in these playoffs. By the way, in the regular season, Jalen Brunson, scoring tear, going higher on his point totals all the time. Joel Embiid, whenever he did actually play, higher on his scoring totals all the time. Victor Wembanyama, for the next 15, 20 years, here's a pro tip for you, take higher on the blocks. That's right. So you're probably wondering, how do you sign up? Oh my God, listener, you are full of good questions today. Sign up with the promo code DING, that's D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. $250, man, that's a lot. Visit underdogfantasy.com or find them in the App Store. And don't forget to register with our code DING, D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick and first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. Must be 18 or older, 21 or older in Massachusetts, Arizona, 19 or older in Alabama and Nebraska, and present in a state where Underdog Fantasy operates. Terms apply. Concerned with your play, call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.ncpgambling.org. Arizona 1-800-NEXT-STEP, that's 1-800-639-8783, or text NEXT STEP to 53342. New York, call the 24/7 HOPE line at 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to another edition of the Woke Bros. I'm Big Waz. Today I'm joined by two fantastic, good lefties. Not the type of lefties that we saw on Curb who fake boycotts and faint at the sight of a MAGA hat. These are true dyed-in-the-wool, tree-hugging hippies, man.
This is how you describe your co-host?
That's right. Nando Villa.
I was gonna say, what happened? We've been doing shows for years, Waz. All of a sudden, what happened?
No, you guys are great. Nando Villa is, you know, out here in Los Angeles, and of course, Michael Brooks on the planet of Brooklyn. We got a fantastic show today lined up for you guys. But first, I want to make sure you guys understand what's going to be happening at the Bell House
in Brooklyn, New York on March 28th. Count the Dings will be live. Myself, Black Trey, Mariano Bivens, Amin El Hassan, Zach Harper, Eden Leh, Nissan Bluestein, Rob Lopez, Anthony Mays, and the whole entire Count the Dings community will be in the house. We got a bunch of special guests lined up. Got guys whose names rhyme with Ablo lined up. You know, we got guys who may or may not have lawyered for all of the people on Power lined up. Man, we just got a few guys coming in. We're trying to make this the biggest show Count the Dings has ever put on. So make sure you go to countthedings.com to get your tickets. They're going to sell out eventually. So I don't want to hear it. Oh, me, why? I thought they was going to still be there. No, hurry up. Get your tickets, man. This thing's going to sell out. You don't want to miss this show. Mike, tell them about the show on February. Is it February 6th?
February 7th, Friday, February 7th.
February 6th is my PMBS. Birthday.
Oh, man, I wish you were there. But regardless, it's going to be an amazing show, even without a brilliant drunk Waz. we've got Alona Minkowski. We've got BJ Sutton. We've got a ton of amazing guests for people that are familiar with the show. There's very few tickets left. We sold out Philly with a couple of days to go. We could be on a similar track. I would go to the link and get your tickets immediately. It's going to be another great show. Excited to see you at Bell House February 7th.
All right. Okay, so on today's show, we want to talk about a spat that Michael, head writer of SNL, Michael Shea, had with a fellow comedy writer. You know, he wrote a dope op-ed piece about it, and I just thought it was, the whole thing was kind of funny. We're going to get into that. Definitely want to talk about MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, you know, sodomizing Jeff Bezos' phone and putting a spell on him, putting a hex on his phone and embarrassing that cat. We're going to get into the hilarity of that. But first, oh, man, establishment, centrist, corporatist Dems are at it again. This time, we got the king and the queen of the corporatist Dem wing of the party, Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton, stirring up crap with Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton, of course, she's dropping a documentary. She did an interview in the Hollywood Reporter where she essentially called Bernie unlikable. People didn't like him. Said that his supporters online were very abrasive, particularly towards women. You know, so she continues in that stereotype, and she's carrying over the grudge from 2015-16. And then, of course, Joe Biden. You know, some Bernie surrogates got found crossways. You know, just spreading some stuff. They kind of misrepresented some Biden stuff from an event that he did, although the overarching theme of what they were trying to explain, which is that Joe Biden will have no problem in a future potential future presidency cutting your granny's Social Security. This is a fact. This is documented. I don't think anybody would be surprised by that. But, you know, Nando, I'll kick it to you first. Why can't these people just let it go as far as Hillary and her team and just the butthurt nature of what happened in 2016?
So I think that what's important to realize now is that we're 2 weeks away from Iowa, the first votes, and Bernie's in the lead. Like, he is unequivocally in the lead. He just took the lead in national polls. He's been either tied or outright in the lead in some of the early state polls, and he's got the most money and the most donors. Well, outside of Bloomberg, the most money, but he's raised the most money. So I think that there is a oh shit moment coming from the ruling class, and they're like, oh my God, like, are we really gonna let this guy win the nomination? So there seems to be a little bit of a coordinated attack to bring him down at the last second. With regards to Clinton specifically, I mean, I think it's important to understand the Clintons as a political machine, not unlike Tammany Hall in New York, you know, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, in that, you know, they derive their power by both, you know, using their immense influence and fundraising and all that stuff, but also punishing anyone that goes against them. And that's why, you know, I think Barack Obama understood this very well in 2008, which is why he cut a deal with the Clintons after beating them in the primary, saying, like, oh, we'll make you Secretary of State, and then I'll clear the field for you 8 years from now. But anyone who crosses the Clintons, and this has been true not just lately with Hillary, but it's part of the Clinton brand from forever, has been to just crush whoever dares go against them from their own side. So, yeah, it's not surprising, and it's happening now. Right at the moment of truth. And I just don't think it's going to have an effect.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it will have much of an effect either. And I think in a general election, if Bernie does become the nominee, it will actually be great for him, because particularly Hillary Clinton is one of the only people in the country that, if you look at opinion polls, is less popular than Donald Trump. And everybody should always remind themselves that Donald Trump is actually very unpopular, right? But I think... I don't know, though. There's a couple of things to me that are really revealing about this. I mean, Nando, you said on their own side. And I think that that's such a, I mean, even though we all know they're not on the same side, you know, the Clintons are classic, you know, oligarch, corruption, big money, corporate Democrats. And Bernie, you know, is this guy, you know, who's been toiling for the poor and underrepresented for decades. And trying to get everybody health care, the opposite of where the Clintons are coming from. But I think it's, you know, they're both in a certain way, at least running in the same party. And I think it's very revealing because, you know, Hillary Clinton, in addition to having this, you know, bitter, entitled, disgusting attitude towards Sanders and his supporters. And of course, she has no reflection on her many failings. She has no embarrassment about being the person who managed to lose to a fucking corrupt predator game show host, right? She has more hatred for Bernie, it feels like, than for Trump. And I just think that that is so revealing of like a certain kind of very perverted mindset in the sort of center and the liberals. It's not even enough to just say, you know, hey, I'm just more right wing. I don't want to do what Bernie wants to do to solve problems. But, you know, if I spend all day hyperventilating about Trump, I can at least, you know, be really clear about, you know, what the main danger is. And I think the truth of the matter is that for a lot of these people, and he's not. I mean, for what it's worth, under Trump, Hillary's going to get huge tax cuts. Under Bernie, her taxes might go up.
So there's a couple of things that just bothers me about this conversation, because I've actually been having these conversations in real life with people who I know. This conversation around the supporters of Senator Sanders, right? This idea that it's a very white, very sexist supporter base, which I think is just – it's just silly. It's just a caricature. It's ignorant, quite frankly. Like, sure, yes, I'm sure there are people online, because the language of the internet, the tenor of the internet is that of snark, is that of, you know, bombast and over-the-topness. So when his – supporters, you know, sort of express themselves on the internet. And again, no, like, I never hear people talk about Bernie supporters in real life. It's always about what happens on Twitter, and which is just like, it's just so a mindlessness to me. And it's actually intellectually dishonest to assume that, or to posit that Bernie's support is just a bunch of angry white dudes on the internet. It's just stupid. And that's just in general with a lot of the people who just, you know, their preferred candidates are losing to Bernie. That gets on my nerves, first of all. But second of all, Hillary Clinton, particularly, this is stupid because she's the one that went with the deplorables thing. Like, that's why this is so stupid on her. Like, why do you think it's a good idea, to be bashing and painting with a broad stroke the supporters of somebody as popular as Bernie this way? and to disparage them and to say, oh, they're just sexist anyway, because you couldn't possibly not want to, you couldn't possibly not like Hillary Clinton or Tulsi Gabbard or any of these other people unless you were sexist. Like, it's just laughable.
I just got
to
say real quick, though, like, even that, and I've leveled plenty of criticisms of Tulsi, but Tulsi's actually a really good example, though, of just how fully and completely and utterly full of shit these people are. Because, look, it's one thing to say, like, not everything, of course, identity matters, and not everything can be reduced to identity, right? Like, I feel like that's the simplest way of putting it, right? If everything was just reduced to identity, then, you know, then vote for Carly Fiorina, vote for Herman Cain, like, nothing to talk about. Barack Obama and Joe Biden got in the way of Sarah Palin being vice president. Total sexism. You know what I mean? Like, and by the way, that is how some people actually talk and carry it in public life in America. And, you know, if that's what you actually believe, you know, that's just cult thinking to me. That's just not serious. If that's like the only thing you see, even as, of course, it's incredibly important. But
yeah, go ahead.
Was the only thing. But if that was the only thing you saw, I mean, Tulsi Gabbard never gets included. You know, like, even when people say, like, oh, like, these, you know, Kamala Harris is dropping out, there's no woman of color left in the race. Well, you know, Tulsi Gabbard is literally a woman of color. Like, you know, Andrew Yang is literally an Asian American who's running a historical presidential campaign in some ways. My line is always the same. Everybody besides Bernie can eat shit, as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, if you're but just even the double standards within even their own rhetoric is just so glaring with these people. And also, you know, when it comes to Bernie, it's like the polls are in. Bernie has a multiracial coalition, period. Bernie has now it's not just among young people. It's broadening out, including consistently majority of Hispanic people and in consistent growth of African Americans. He's got it. So you're just erasing people. And then the last, it's like, first of all, everybody's an asshole on Twitter. And secondly, like, I don't know what this means, because, you know, I used to take it face value, because I have no doubt. I know that everybody can be horrible. But now it's like, I've seen articles or, you know, people saying, like, oh my God, these Bernie bros are being so horrible. And then the example is either like you're saying Waz, just normal snark, or actually somebody saying, like, hey, I would like to hold you publicly accountable for a lie you told on television. And the response is, oh, violence. So it's all just a bunch of, like, you know, woke bullshit and dishonesty.
And Nando, I want you to jump in here really quick, but I just want to say another thing that I think is important for people to understand. When you're broad brushing the Bernie people with the deplorables people, there was no secret about what Donald Trump's rhetoric was, and therefore why he engendered such enthusiasm amongst his base. It was Mexican people are evil, rapists, taking jobs from good, hardworking, potato-eating Americans, right? we need to get rid of that. That was the animating feature of his campaign, to otherize people from Mexico. That was the unifying theme. Sure, there was the stuff about anti-free trade that I think animated some of his people. I think that always got overblown, how anti-free trade his base was, and that really got their panties moist. I don't think that was the case. I think what got them excited was, quite frankly, the racism. Like, there's no two ways about it. Now, we have to stupidly contrast this with Bernie's support group. It's working class people issues. It's healthcare. It's not going into extreme debt to fund college, which has become a prerequisite to any kind of decently paying job these days. And just these basic things. Like, this is like the moral imperative there. It's not even comparable, dude. It's a group of people who are scared of brown people, scared of people who are Muslim, and think the worst of them and think they're evil simply because they are not white. And then a group of people who think everybody should have health care. I don't even understand how people can make the argument. Just morally, these two people don't belong in the same group. Sorry, Nando, please go on.
Yeah. I mean, so a CNN poll came out today that put Bernie in the lead in terms of overall national support. He was leading Biden by 3 points in this CNN poll that came out today. That same poll broke down the support between white and non-white people. And Sanders is leading with non-white people. He's got 30% of non-white support, while Biden comes in second at 27%. Warren is at 16%, Yang at 6%, Bloomberg at 5%, and Buttigieg all the way down at 4% with non-white people. So this idea that Bernie's supporters are uniquely white and male or whatever is not borne out in the data at all, like at all. So it's very, very frustrating when you hear that. Now, in terms of like the racial appeals of someone like Trump and how to the extent that that's successful, it's true, but it's also true that in times of economic collapse, in moments of crisis of capitalism, whatever you want to call it, that has led to an increase in the appeal of racist sentiments. I mean, this was like a very sort of mainstream belief for the longest time, was that the rise of fascism in Europe in the 1930s was directly related to the crisis of capitalism in the 1920s. That the economic collapse of Germany and after World War I and the Treaty of Versailles led directly to the rise of fascism. I mean, this was like a very standard mainstream view. And we shouldn't be surprised that basically 8 years after the crisis in 2008, we get a similar kind of overtly racist campaign achieving some success in the United States and across Western Europe as well. So it's not a coincidence. They don't happen in isolation. They are predictable outcomes of this economic reality. Now, obviously, like a Bernie presidency would not end racism or sexism or any of those things, but it is true that it would help mitigate those things greatly, because it just makes them it makes the appeal less salient in people's lives. Like they just don't sound as necessary when, you know, you feel like you're part of something bigger, when you feel like you're part of a movement, when you feel like the person next to you is on the same team as you, rather than the opposite, which is when you're downwardly mobile, you start to think that everyone is a potential threat or a competitor. So these things used to be kind of commonly understood, but they're now being obfuscated. I mean, if you looked at Bernie's interview with the New York Times editorial board for that whole endorsement fiasco, he makes that exact same point, which the look on all the people in the New York Times was like as if he said some sort of insane, like if you just said that the earth was flat, like it was like they were astonished to hear him make this incredibly boring, banal point that was common knowledge forever up until very recently.
Yeah, I also just want to add to that. Like, I think the other thing that I've been noticing people have been saying, right, is, well, you know, there's a lot of like very affluent white people who are racist, so that proves that the economics don't play a role in this. And that's just actually the dumbest comment I've ever heard, because that's so radically stupid, because it just requires like 5 minutes of thinking, right? And you could say, okay, there's two categories that we're talking about, right? Like, one is, why does some, you know, schmo who's downwardly mobile get drawn into these racist appeals? And of course, we know that there's obviously, this is a historically racist and white supremacist country, so it fits into that. But also, we know that all the things Nando just said are at work, right? But then, like, rich people, it's like, yeah, because they have an incentive structure to keep power dynamics frozen into place. So, of course, they would embrace belief systems, whether it be racism or anything else, that would reinforce status quo. And the full circle I want to draw on that's interesting to me is that there's some new research kind of showing that like white people are starting to hate each other more than ever. And that's not just because, you know, white people are annoying and melodramatic, which they are. I agree with you, Waz, but it's also that.
You stupid.
They are, though. I can't. Look, I'm not running for office. I could say it. It's true. True enough. But it's a product of historical forces. White people are annoying. But I think. But like. The thing that was so interesting about it is, like, it's basically showing that, like, if you had to simplify it, and I want to know what you guys think of this, it's basically like the liberal white people, who, by the way, what's funny to me is that they're these same people in the 90s, even if you look at, like, the Clintons, who still would have been considered liberal, would have been absolutely what we consider to be, like, hugely racist. Because yeah. Anytime they talked about, you know, you go back and you look at, like, how, I mean, you know, we've talked about this a million times, Waz, right? How, like, wait a second, Hillary Clinton, like, not that many years ago was saying that crime happens because black kids don't pull their pants up, right?
Yeah.
Facts. And now what you see with this same demographic of people is that positively they're starting to drop the racism, right? That's the positive. And then but what they're not doing is just generally saying, like, oh, so I should drop all bullshit like that. They're turning into, like, well, I get that I was an asshole about race and poverty, but oh, if you're a poor white person in Appalachia, fuck you. You have toxic masculinity and blah, blah, blah. And all of this, like, dumb bullshit that they're reading from, like, stupid websites. And it's keeping, and ironically, in a way, it serves the same purpose, because in all of these cases, it's a story that people justify to basically not pay more taxes, like, yeah, not give up their shit. You know what I mean? And that's Hillary Clinton, like, in a fucking nutshell. Like, I mean, if I was Bernie Sanders, I would have said, yeah, nobody likes me on fucking, like, Jeffrey Epstein's island. Like, fuck you.
All right. Yeah. So, like, one last thing I want to address, because I want to move on to Joe Biden and get up in his ass real quick. But the one last thing I want to address is.
That's what she said.
Yeah, seriously. That sounds like fun.
Is wow. That there's this persistent criticism that Bernie is somehow running some type of colorblind campaign, which I don't think has any truth to it. But whatever, bear with me here. I don't think that there's any truth to this, but what I will tell people, black people specifically, Barack Obama ran a colorblind campaign, straight up and down. Like, the dude straight up and down just never would mention black people, the fact that he's black. He would do stuff like, I'm gonna go to a black church and speak in the same cadence that black preachers speak in, and sort of a wink and a nod, but he never came out and said, you know, black people got a raw deal out here and we got to deal with that shit. Never, never. As a matter of fact, when he finally became president, you know, they got in his ass just for saying Trayvon Martin could be my son. You know, and I'm just saying, like, again, Hillary did something a little different. She actually did a lot of the... And a lot of it, let's just face it, at the time we called it cringeworthy, the hot sauce in her purse, the freaking, the abuela, the freaking having the mothers of the movement women up on stage at the DNC, like, just having a bunch of mothers of black kids who got killed by police up there. Like, the optics were so tricky with that. And that makes me wonder, like, what do people actually want? You know, like,
well,
we
the
all
thing I want to throw to you guys. Can I throw to you guys just yeah. what you're yeah, saying, Waz? Because I feel like this is the same thing, though, that we're talking about in a different way. Like, setting aside the idea of, like, a colorblind campaign and, you know, that critique, which I think maybe there at times there was validity in 2000. There was some validity in 2016. I think way, way less this time. But even beyond that, like, what are we really talking about? Like, I guess, like, I feel like if you're talking about an actual policy area and you're saying, like, you don't have a thing, like, specifically on, you know, housing discrimination as just one of many examples, okay. But then it starts to become like,
no, that's not what people are talking about.
Everybody needs health care. So are we saying that, like,
No, that's not what
Bernie's
people are talking
about. Bernie's the asshole for not talking about health
care? No, but what they're talking about is
Migos, like, which is condescending and gross that she did that, in my opinion.
No, I think what they're talking about is something, it's more visceral. It's like they feel like what Bernie, like when Bernie harps on class, they say his harping on the class stuff shows his ignorance of the race. That like the argument is that he's so tied into class that way because he fundamentally doesn't understand the role that race plays. I don't agree with that assessment. I think once you talk about class, like especially as it as it happens or works itself out in this country, nobody with half a brain could ignore the race component like that. Like that's why I reject that argument. Like, you would have to assume an extreme level of ignorance on Bernie Sanders for him to care about class in such a way that he doesn't think race matters in America. Like, I don't know where this argument comes from, but I see it all the time, and it persists amongst a certain type of black person specifically. I can't speak for Latinx people or Asian people or Indian people or, you know, any of the other minority groups that we have here in the country. But I know black people specifically because, you know, let's face it, black people's relationship to the country as immigrants, as all of that stuff is different from Asian people and, you know, Latinx people. It's just a different relationship just by virtue of the fact that so many people are like, you know, they've been hit. Their family goes back for hundreds of years, right? So I think that's what I'm talking about, Mike. They're just like, they feel like spiritually Bernie doesn't get it, which, again, I think is stupid.
This is so weird because any fair reading of Bernie's life and record would put him at the absolute forefront of anti-racist struggles in the last four decades. I mean, this is a guy who got arrested at a civil rights march in the 1960s, he got arrested. He's a man who was one of like four white elected officials in the entire United States to endorse and campaign for Jesse Jackson in 1988, when it would seem like absolutely insane for a black man to be running for president. And that was just openly talked about in polite liberal circles, in the pages of the Washington Post and the New York Times, you know, good liberals like wondered whether the black man could win the presidency, and Bernie rejected that flat out. But the thing about class and the quote unquote class versus race thing, which is a totally false dichotomy. There is no reason why one would preclude the other. But the reason why talking about class is potent as a political message is that it highlights the commonalities and self-interests of various groups of voters, right? And at the end of the day, politics is about that. It's about bringing in diverse groups of people with, you know, diverse cultural sensibilities and geographic sensibilities and backgrounds and all that stuff into a common political project, into a common struggle to fight, you know, the powers that be, so to speak. And class is a potent way to talk about that because it can link people that would previously not see themselves as part of the same group. So it builds, it's a way of building power, of expanding your political coalition to be able to take on moneyed interests, powerful interests, the media, all the things that sort of rule over our society. The only thing the rest of us got is numbers. That's the only thing we got. We don't have power. You know what I mean? And the only thing we have power in is that there's more of us than there are of them. So if you highlight that common self-interest, because at the end of the day, people vote in their self-interest, then you can sort of reorient the message away from these racist demagogues that want to divide people. I mean, it's fairly simple in that sense. Which doesn't mean that you ignore the history of white supremacy in this country and anti-colonial struggles and all that stuff. It's absolutely worth talking about and crucial to talk about. And Bernie does talk about it all the time. I mean, if you just go to any one of his rallies, you can see it. I mean, it's to say that they're race blind is just false. But that's why class is a potent political message. It's the way that we can band together to actually take power, and more importantly than exercise power.
Very well said, Nando. We got to move on to Joe Biden. Nando, you actually, and I want to kick back to you. So you actually have a better handle on what exactly it is Joe Biden is butthurt about today and saying, well, I got the apology, but it, you know, the part about me being corrupt and blah, 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 blah. Can you explain to everybody what got Joe Biden crossways?
So in the last couple weeks, it seems very clear that the Bernie campaign has set their sights on Joe Biden. They realize that Joe Biden is still kind of near the top of the race, if not at the top in some polls, and that he really is the big bad. It doesn't seem like Warren and Buttigieg are really challenging him. Bernie is way ahead of them. Biden is his real competitor. So they've set their sights on Biden. They first set their sights on his record in Iraq, and talking about Biden's vote for the Iraq war and his subsequent support for the war effort, which Biden has repeatedly lied about. And then the second line of attack that they were unveiling was on Biden's history of calling for cuts in Social Security. This is obviously true. It's 100% verifiable. It's actually not even that. I'm surprised it's even that controversial, because cutting Social Security was a mainstream elite liberal belief for a very, very long time, including Barack Obama, who led the effort to cut Social Security as part of his grand bargain. Biden was, of course, his vice president, so he obviously supported that whole effort. So it's not a controversial thing. The problem arose when the Bernie campaign used a video, used the transcript of a video of Biden talking about cutting Social Security in a sort of sarcastic way. It was just like a bad example to use. And people pointed out that Biden wasn't really saying what they were saying he was saying in that video, and there's some validity to it. But it's kind of like missing the forest for the trees. Biden has a long record of opposing Social Security, of supporting Social Security cuts. So it's a totally fair critique, but the media has run with this narrative that Bernie lied about it. The Washington Post fact checker did a whole thing on it, and it was pretty embarrassing. And then the other thing is that a Bernie surrogate, a woman named Zephyr Teachout, who's a very smart academic and Bernie surrogate and who ran for attorney general in New York, said in an op-ed that Biden had a corruption problem. And for some reason, the Bernie campaign, Bernie himself apologized for using that term to apply to Biden. I don't know what you guys think. I think the term corrupt is 100% applicable to Biden and what happened with Hunter in the Ukraine, not to mention Biden's entire career, sort of pushing whatever the credit card companies in Delaware tell him to do, bankruptcy bill, all that stuff. But for whatever reason, Bernie thought that that line of attack was not an effective one, so he apologized for it. But he has not apologized for using the Social Security attack.
Yeah, I think, you know, corruption, I don't have any problem. I certainly don't. I thought Zephyr Teachout's piece was great, and it's a totally fine way to describe Biden. Although I think for once, the Bernie campaign, which I would like to see be a little bit more aggressive and ruthless, which I think they're going to need to be, I think in this case, it was strategic, because I think that Bernie just kind of was like, let's not get into all the melodrama and smelling salts about this word corrupt, because I want that out of the way to grind this motherfucker's face on Social Security. And I actually think it was might have made some, like, you know, tactical sense. But yeah, to be really clear, I mean, Joe Biden has been calling for cutting Social Security and Medicare for decades. And he actually offered those cuts with Obama as part of a grand bargain to Republicans in 2010, 2011, the only reason it didn't happen is because the Republicans were so insane that they wouldn't take like an 80% deal on their terms. So you know, Joe Biden has a terrible record on this stuff, and people should really know about it.
Yeah, and the bottom line, stuff, Mike, he's not running on expanding Social Security. and he claims he is,
but that's a lie.
Yeah. Right. No one believes it. Yeah.
Like that's not your history. And again, quite frankly, Barry stupidly put it on the table as like to say, like, this is you guys' favorite thing to do. We're willing to talk about it.
What I really want to underscore is if you've ever spent any time inside elite circles, which I have, not to be like all name droppy, but
Nando.
Yeah. No. This idea that Social Security is fundamentally going to explode any minute now because it's just totally bankrupt and needs to be cut dramatically because the country is totally bankrupt and the Social Security pension fund is not going to be able to finance itself. And we need to cut Social Security and we need to expand the retirement age and we need to means test. All this stuff is just like is as inevitable to them as the weather. Like the need to cut Social Security for, say, like someone who's in the Council of Foreign Relations is as banal as the sun rising in the east. You know, like this is thoroughly mainstream elite opinion, both in Republican circles and liberal Democratic circles. I mean, this is why Barack Obama focused so much on it, because fundamentally Barack Obama has always wanted the approval of this kind of people. So this is, it's so obvious and standard. And it's just to have the media now portray this as an outrageous attack on Biden. I mean, this is crazy. It's crazy. I mean, it's everyone believes this. I mean, I remember talking to John King.
But you know why though, Nando?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you. The reason why is because the status quo of our system is corruption. Like the lobbying system is corruption. Like the campaign donors system where you can get, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars contributed to your campaign by a certain type of industry that you are then expected to write and legislate laws that govern that industry. That's corruption. That's why these people got their panties in a bunch just at the idea that we would call what is just known as doing business in D.C. what it actually is, and that's corruption. But sorry, go on about John King for me, please, brother.
No, well, you're right. That the real scandal in terms of corruption is not what's illegal. It's what's actually totally legal and accepted. You know, to them, that's the real problem in the American system. But no, I remember having talking to John King. I was at some event, and he was just standing next to me, and we were just chatting. And he's like, "Hey, you're young." I'm like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Do you ever expect to have Social Security like when you retire?" Of course not. Like, you know, like it's taken as such accepted fact that Social Security is doomed unless it's cut. You know, it's just I can't stress
that's
enough
that's so antithetical to how things like the reason it would be doomed is because you want to cut it.
Yeah, like, you know, like if you don't want to do it, just fund it more.
Like, you know, it's just so funny to me, right. Like something that costs way less, like the military. Nobody ever says, "Yo, the military's doomed. It's just so much bloat and we can't afford it." Like nobody ever says that because nobody believes that we would ever let the military fail. Like it would just like that idea. It just like. People will look at you with three heads like, damn, like, do you think we could, you think in 100 years we'll be able to afford the military? And people will be like, what?
Yeah.
Of course.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
And I just want to say real quick, because I've been noticing that the Biden campaign, they dug up, I mean, this is great balls. They dug up like one line from Bernie Sanders saying in 1996 that there might be adjustments in Social Security. And I guarantee you that unlike Biden, he did not mean raising the retirement age or cutting benefits. What he means is that basically you should lift the Social Security cap so wealthy people can get taxed at Social Security at a higher rate to help fund the program.
Yeah.
I guarantee you that's what he meant. And I just also want to add, too, that we always like roll our eyes when Joe Biden says like, you know, yeah, like once you get rid of Trump, like then me and my, you know, the Republicans will be fine. And obviously everybody points out, you know, it ignores the racism, the xenophobia, the craziness, the corruption, the authoritarianism, all of the things that define the Republican Party. But I will say this, he's partially right, because what he could be talking about is he's president, him and Mitch McConnell sit down and a bunch of Republicans and a lot of, you know, corporate oligarch Democrats sit down and they cut Medicare and Social Security.
Yeah.
Like, this that's is how totally Biden, on the table.
That's how he's Biden been trying made to his
do
career.
It for decades. He's been trying to do it for decades. Like, people got to know it. And it's crazy, too, because, like, just like the corruption stuff, which obviously Donald Trump doesn't give a fuck. Of course, Donald Trump's the most corrupt guy ever. He doesn't care. He'll run on corruption. And, of course, Donald Trump is going to pass the Republican agenda, which includes cutting Social Security. But that won't stop him from attacking Joe Biden for this. Like, right. It's just these totally unnecessary vulnerabilities.
Crazy.
Yeah, and we can move on from Biden. You know, like we say it every week, right. But like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you are in the pockets of the banks. Like, you're a financial services institution whore and hack. We're gonna say it every week. That's what and who you are. And you know, and that's just it. And just to close it off, just to make people understand stuff. When you have these discussions and people say, well, Bernie's agenda is too extreme, I don't think it's ever going to pass, so blah, 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 blah. Nobody ever thinks like that on the Republican side. When they run on repeal and whatever, Obamacare, blah, 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 and quote unquote, all they get is just completely damaging the program and ruining it, they're good with that. Like, yeah, we didn't get repeal and replace. We ran on repeal and replace because that's what we do. But guess what? Our aim was to damage this law, and we were able to do that quite significantly, too. We only had to stop at pre-existing conditions because, goddamn, our honkies told us not to. Right. So when I hear people say stupid shit like, oh, well, Bernie's a little too extreme and the moderates aren't going to shut up. Shut up. It just makes no sense to do that. Nobody does this on the other side. Nobody moderates a message. They get in there and figure out what they can get from what they actually wanted. All right, cool. Once I'm in there, I'll figure out how to work a way to get the stuff that I like out of it. If I can't get 100%, but I'm not going to campaign on some watered down version of what I actually would like to be doing. Sorry. End of rant.
No, absolutely.
All right, moving along to some, you know, some funnier news. It was reported this week that the reason Bezos's nudes got leaked and his phone was, you know, was in the hands of his enemies is that he was in a text correspondence with fellow overlord and oligarch MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And the guy sent him some malware and hacked his phone. I will note that our president is in a long-running feud with Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post specifically. And his son-in-law is butt buddies with MBS. Just a thought as we're laughing and dissecting this. Nando, I just, you know... I just thought it was funny that Jeff Bezos was text buddies and WhatsApping MBS. Like, what do you think they talked about? Like, Premier League soccer? Like, what do you think those
like
two...
Like, sending funny memes to each other, you know? Right. Like, who the hell knows? I mean, it's... Someone a while ago made, like, a joke tweet on Twitter, and it's, like, stuck in my head, and it's, like, you know... Obviously, we believe in a better world and we believe that we're going to change this sort of dystopian inequality and oligarchy that we live in. But there is a chance that the oligarchs will just continue to rule and dominate and that the future will just be us watching billionaires fight against each other. We have like our champions, you know, like I'm on team Bezos and I'm on team, Peter Thiel and like, and they, yeah, Zuckerberg, and they
on Team MBS.
Yeah, you think so? I mean, MBS is such a dumbass.
Oh, compared to Bezos, yeah, definitely. But Bezos, at least look, Bezos, he's got a right to rule, man. He's got a claim to the throne. Well, Bezos, the fucking nerd.
Bezos is from Miami, though.
Allah, so of course he has the right to.
Yeah, Allah told him he's got a nice smile. He hit Jeff Bezos with a, you know, you up.
Yeah. I don't know. I would probably choose like some Chinese billionaire who likes to
go,
and you know, yeah. But that's really the reality. I mean, and this is kind of an example of that. Watching these two oligarchs, you know, fight, and obviously, like, I don't support leaking someone's nudes and extorting them, but it's Bezos, who's literally the most richest man in the history of ever. So it's kind of funny to see that even he's vulnerable to getting his phone hacked. But the fact that MBS, I mean, it's just funny, all this MBS news coming out. I mean, obviously the murder of Khashoggi and all that stuff is horrible, but like, again, in the wake of his totally disgusting and shameful goodwill tour throughout the United States, in which every sort of liberal and conservative elite pundit slobbered all over his feet, saying like, well, oh my God, look, he's going to reform the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And like, he just turns out to be just this comically dumb and evil guy. It's just funny to me. Like, I kind of revel in that.
What do you think? Worried about Jeff Bezos?
No, I'm absolutely not worried about Jeff Bezos. I just think it's hilarious how these things play out just in real time, right? Like, we wouldn't know that Jeff Bezos was having a correspondence with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, but in certain ways we should expect that he is, right? Like, he's the richest guy in America, and, you know, which means that he's one of the most important people, unfortunately. Like, that's how our system works. That's the system of global capitalism. But the, you know, just the idea that a guy is leaking another guy's nudes is just, it's just funny. I don't know what to say. It's just so funny, just as an idea or a concept, you know. I don't think that it ever occurred to me to think about the source of the Bezos, you know, nudes leaking, and the source of that, you know, his phone being hacked. Like, that would have never, it just never crossed my mind that, you know, I should be thinking about who actually did this to the dude. So, you know, reading this stuff definitely gave me a few laughs, man.
Yeah.
I mean, do we know, like, is it, I mean, we know he got hacked. It's not proven yet that this is the same thing as the reason that Jeff's nudes got hacked, leaked, because it could have been
according to his
like divorce or something.
Yeah, well, according to Bezos' own security guy, the head of his security guy, he basically established that it was MBS that hacked his phone, and then shortly after, so then he started looking into the relationship of MBS and David Pecker, who's the head of the company that owns, obviously his name is David Pecker, which is hilarious, but he's the company, yeah, the head of the company. Say,
you're not going to let me laugh for a minute.
Yeah.
Guys.
You got to laugh. Yeah. But yeah, he's the guy who owns the National Enquirer, who is the newspaper that was going to leak the sex of Jeff Bezos. So it seems like the circumstantial evidence is pretty powerful. If MBS hacked his phone, and it turns out MBS is tight with the head of the National Enquirer, aka the newspaper that got the contents of Bezos's phone, right?
And yeah, to reiterate what Mike said, actually, I think it was Nando who said it. It is type. It's reassuring that, like, you know, Bezos, who's like, you know, he works in technology. Like, this is. Like, it's not like Warren Buffett or something. Yeah. Like, dude, like, you're a tech billionaire. Like, you're supposed to be technologically savvy in a way that MBS can't just get all up in your business like this. So it's kind of funny. It makes me feel like, all right, you know, I'm not such a dummy. For that time that I put a virus on my mom's computer when I was watching porn, you know? Like, I'm not such a dumb guy for doing that, for having done that. Yeah, I think we can move on from this. And last but not least, what's this comedian homie's this comedy writer homie's name?
Jack Allison.
Jack Allison. Who Nando and Michael have both been guests on his podcast. I guess I'm not important enough or funny enough to ever have been invited.
No, it's actually nuts that they should definitely have you. It's a struggle session. Leslie Lee III and Jack Allison. Actually, in matter of fact, you should definitely be on that podcast.
Yeah,
but at any rate, it's Jack Allison.
Anyway, he wrote an op-ed about a spat that he had with Michael Che that spanned, basically a year or so, that I thought was just very interesting because it's just a commentary about our lives, our digital lives now, right? The concept that it's just so funny. Like the head writer of SNL could be online bullying some random guy who I don't even think applied for the SNL gig that he was dissing, right? Like just in 2020, like these two people can have interactions for no real reason at all, but just the culture of the internet is such that we squabble like this.
I mean, the crazy thing is that this all started when Jack, who used to write for Jimmy Kimmel, so he's like been a working sketch comedy writer in the biz, so to speak, and so he knows how it works, was looking at the SNL submission packet for writers, which is something very common. Like if you're applying for a writing job at Tonight Show or SNL or whatever, you send a packet and then they make you sign something that says that if they ever use an idea that's similar to yours in this packet, that you can't sue them, right? It's just a way for them to protect themselves. But he noticed that in the SNL one, they include all the things that you've ever posted on social media is fair game for them to use, which is kind of crazy. And so he pointed it out on Twitter. He just like made a comment on it, like, this is fucked up, and didn't tag SNL, didn't tag Michael Che, didn't tag anyone. And according to him, it got like 12 retweets and like 16 faves. And all of a sudden Michael Che is putting a screenshot of it on his Instagram and talking shit. And he thought that was like weird and that was going to be like a thing that lasted a day. But Michael Che ended up just like screenshotting all his tweets for months and talking shit about him on Instagram, which is just the most insane, deranged behavior. Like I can remember, especially because like, again, Michael Che is the head writer of SNL. It's like literally one of the most coveted comedy jobs in America. And Jack Allison, who's a very smart and very funny guy, you know, at the end of the day, he's got like his own little podcast, which is like a niche kind of like leftist nerdy podcast, which is, you know, it's got his like little following, but it's like nowhere near SNL. Yeah. So like just to see this guy punching down to this, you know, fairly much more anonymous fellow comedy writer, is just, it's insane behavior. And it was just, it speaks to a lot of the thin-skinnedness that I would say has been revealed of elite people in the age of Twitter and social media. Because before, they were like fairly inoculated from these kind of critiques, you know, like no one could talk shit to the head of the SNL right. 30 years ago. Like that was just like literally impossible. You have to like go and find him at his house or something. But now when they write an unfunny sketch about like Trump and Covfefe or something, they get people on Twitter make fun of them for it and they don't like it.
Yeah, I'm actually on the other side of this a little bit. And not like, I don't even care about Michael Che. It's just I can understand as somebody whose job involves being on the internet and dealing with the comments and the peanut gallery, if you will, of certain people on the internet. Just the idea that you get to talk shit and nobody gets to address it, I just don't agree with that idea. Like, you can say, yo, you're more important than me, Michael Che, in this world. And, you know, you have this level of following, blah, 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 blah. But, like, look, you shouldn't throw stones and hide your hand is what I'm saying. Like, well, if you talk shit, people might read it and people might get at you.
Well, here's what I'll say. Like, it didn't start with him talking shit about Michael Che. You know, he didn't.
Well, mention, he said the show that he's in charge of running is unfunny. I don't
know. No. It started off with him talking shit about this idea that if you submit your packet to SNL, they can then use all your social media as a source of jokes without crediting you or without you being able to, you know, it's a very weird clause in their contract. So he wasn't commenting. He subsequently talked shit about how he found SNL to be unfunny and how Michael Che is unfunny. But that Michael Che was the original guy who swung first in the sense that, you know, what Jack Allison was complaining about was he was just pointing it out, was a very sort of reasonable thing to point out. He wasn't commenting on he wasn't talking shit, so to speak. Like, he wasn't talking about, like, yo, SNL's bullshit. Like, that was the source of it, was this weird clause in their contract.
Well, that's what started it. But if you read the headline of the article, it says, "My feud with Saturday Night Live head writer has started several months, all because, as I said, his show was unfunny." That's his reading of the situation, is what I'm saying. Like, okay, so forget about that. That's a one. Another thing that I found was interesting, it's kind of just the hubris or the self-delusion that a lot of us go through, whatever. I'm you know, guilty of it too, but just the idea that, like, shit from your Twitter feed would make it onto SNL. like the idea that you're brimming with tweets that are good enough.
Well, to be fair, if you watch SNL, they would beg for my Twitter.
Sure.
I mean, that's the most unfunny shit I've ever seen in my life.
Sure.
I mean, but here's the thing. I agree that, because it happens on every level, right? Like, you don't have to be Michael Che. Like, you can, right, you know, we can get, like, bullshit from various, you know, whatever, right? And absolutely every single person in the world has a right to smack back. Like, I actually think that's one of the things that people don't understand about, you know, how Trump is working on certain audiences. And I'm just saying this objectively. Like, I think when Trump actually makes fun of a journalist with muscular dystrophy, I think everybody besides sociopaths or like 12-year-olds are like, yes, that's fucked up. But I also think there's plenty of other scenarios where, you know, people look at what Trump's reaction is and then they don't realize that in a lot of people's minds, Trump is doing the same thing the other person is doing, just more funny, basically. So I get what you're saying, Waz. It's not that Michael Che doesn't have a right to hit back and say whatever comment he wants to make. And in fact, the way all this stuff works, like, I remember when this first started, and it is crazy that it's still going on, because this really was a year ago. I mean, you know, Struggle Session, it is actually legit. That's the thing I want to get to in a second. It's crazy the legs that this has had.
Yeah.
But, you know, Struggle Session was already a, you know, successful, like, 1,000+ patron or whatever. And they grew. Like, they had all of this attention. Their whole thing, their whole profile grew because Michael Che was bitching and whining. Yeah. And I think that's kind of what, I mean, first of all, the SNL packet thing, that is insane. That is so exploitative. That is so unethical. Yeah, that is so outrageous. And then it's that Michael Che isn't really, I mean, he's popping some jokes off, but they're not really that funny.
Right.
And he's kind of obsessed with it. And that's the only reason he's losing. And what I kind of wonder as I look at it, I definitely don't watch Saturday Night Live. That's not just a posture. I don't. I mean, I didn't even watch all of when Eddie Murphy hosted it. I watched several sketches. But, you know, I've heard Michael Che caught certain things here and there, and clear, like, he's a funny guy. He's not like
He's personally funny in his act. I don't know if he's talented enough to make SNL and Lorne Michaels' comedic sensibility is funny. I don't know that anybody
tested it is and everything else. But I think what Allison might have pointed to this a little bit, where, you know, because Jack Allison used to write for Jimmy Kimmel,
mm-hmm,
and he's kind of saying, you know, is he upset because, like, I used to be in the club or something? And I think that is what's interesting about it. Is there a part of Che that understands that SNL is embarrassing?
Yes.
And he's bothered that this, you know, because he agrees. Do you know what I'm saying? Because that's why is he still talking about it?
Yeah, that's a fair point right there. If you really thought that you were making, I don't know, the Chappelle show, you wouldn't be too caught up about what this dude has to say about your job. I think that's extremely telling.
You imagine some guy comes at you from the Chappelle show, you're like actually, I think it's derivative and not as inventive as you think. You're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, well, exactly.
That I'm Marilyn Monroe. Like, okay, like the dude in front of Penn Station sniffing glue had thoughts too. Like, thank you. Bye. But if you work on Saturday Night Live, you might be like, oh, god damn it. He's right.
Yeah. 100. Beautiful point.
Well, those are the criticisms that hurt the most, right? You know, which is why, for example, like libs hate criticism from their left more than criticism from their right. You know what I mean? Because like they can dismiss criticism from the right as like just outrageous nonsense, and yeah, of course. But when it comes from their left, it's like they secretly know that they're right and they're true. So it just makes them even more angry, which is why, you know, like that's why, for example, Hillary Clinton hates Bernie more than Trump.
And why Michael Che can't stop talking about Jack Allison.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
well, there you go. We just compared Michael Che to Hillary Clinton. So we've done our jobs for today. Here on the Woke Bros again. Make sure you get your tickets for Count the Dings Live at the Bell House in Brooklyn on March 28th at countthedings.com. Of course, Mike, where can people buy tickets for the TMBS show on February 7th?
Well, we'll have a link in the show description. But now for everything, go to tmbs.fm. You can get merch, hoodies, TMBS hoodies. You can become a patron, and you can definitely get a link to buy tickets to TMBS live shows like February 7th at the Bell House. You guys are awesome. We'll be back next week. Thanks, y'all.
All right, man. Thank you for Michael Brooks, Fernando Villa. I'm Big Waz.
We're out. Later, y'all.
Take it easy.